Chapter 4. The History of Witchcraft in Egypt. So far, we have seen that the definition of Wicca is witchcraft, because they are the same word, and there are all kinds of witches all over the world. How can we be protected from witchcraft? It is only through Jesus. That is always a safe answer. If you just try shouting squirrel, or claim it is a KFC issue, you are on the wrong track and probably need to get saved. Jesus, of course, is who you need if you are not a Christian yet, you need to get saved. But if you are saved and you experience spiritual warfare, even from occult people, you do not have to worry because you can always call on the name and authority of Jesus to help against any evil. In the last couple chapters, we've been looking at the history of witchcraft and how it has ended up in all societies through time since the Tower of Babel, as well as even our Christian nation, the United States of America, which is full of the occult. Occult practices originated from Babylon at the time of the Tower of Babel, and that Babylonian sewer pipe of the occult has oozed out onto the whole planet. It began from Babylonian man's rebellion shortly after the flood. In fact, we saw many familiar occult practices and beliefs that came from Babylon, including vampires, which was not just a Western Europe thing, as believed by some who have not done the homework. We saw Babylon had many types of vampires like Ikimu, Uruku/Utiku, Succubi/Incubi, and the vampire's seven demons, with the latter being where we got the idea that vampires suck people's blood. Again, this is nothing new under the sun, including vampires. Others were Lamashtu, Lilith, and Vrikalakas. Another aspect of witchcraft history has been the words used like abracadabra. And we will see more of that in this chapter. Witchcraft has their prescribed recipes for witches who need to understand other aspects of words like exact names, pronunciations, and meanings, as well as the precise name of the person they want to attack. Words are huge in witchcraft. And that too, is nothing new because it went on way back in Babylon with the exact same practices, like water purification, magic circles and witchcraft potions. People think those beliefs started back in places like England or Scotland, but it was Babylon, the sewer pipe of occult belief and practices. And why Babylon? What happened there? Of course, that was the Tower of Babel. In fact, the occult got so bad there that God confused the language, so people suddenly spoke in many different tongues. No longer understanding each other, the people spread out, and guess where witchcraft found its next prominent home? It was Egypt, which is the history we'll study in this chapter. Now, before doing this research, I knew that ancient Egyptians had occult practices, but after looking into it, I thought, you've got to be kidding me. It turns out that all those hieroglyphics we see on the inside of the pyramid walls, on their sarcophaguses, coffins, and on the Egyptian papyrus archaeologists have found, are not writings about their victories of war, the weather, animals, or anything like that. It is actually witchcraft. And you are going to find that out too. The truth is absolutely crazy. Whether alive or dead, in ancient Egypt, the whole place was flooded in witchcraft. And what I want to demonstrate, once again, is that biblical history is always right. Of course, God gives us the truth every time. After starting in Babylon, how do we know it really went to Egypt next? Well, we are going to trace that, both biblically and otherwise historically. Let's take a look at Genesis 11:5-9, talking about the Tower of Babel, which was shortly after the flood. And believe it or not, a worldwide flood did not keep those people's attention. A relatively short couple hundred years later, man was already rebelling against God again. And it was not just that they built a tower, they also disobeyed God by not spreading out like he told them to, so they would repopulate the planet. Man decided to build a city and stay local. Then they had the audacity in their rebellion to build this tower that stood against God. They got involved in witchcraft and then spread that to the world after God judged the people and their tower. Let's take a look at Genesis 11, starting with verse 5.
But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that men were building. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them."
And the interesting aspect of this is today's move back to only one language. With our interpretation technology that is constantly improving, you do not have to learn another language, just speak into your phone, and it will spit the words right back in almost any other language you want. And according to Bible prophecy, this is coming along just in time for another rebellion under the headship of the Antichrist. Here is more from Genesis, with the "us" of course being the Trinity.
"Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So, the Lord scattered them from there, Babylon, over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because that was where the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth.
So we see in the text that, right after the flood, God had to judge these people again. You would think wiping out virtually all of mankind would get their attention, resonating in their brains more than a couple of generations. But they apparently didn't get the message that we were not to disobey God as they had in those days of Noah. These Tower of Babel people were not just back at it, they were steeped in witchcraft. They were not only sticking together to build a tower in defiance of God, that route quickly made them crazy wicked. So, God came down, confused the languages, and suddenly when two pals were working near each other, trading jokes and talking sports, Frank asked Joe to pass a hammer and his buddy replied with something like, "Eust quero." Then Frank shot back to ask what in the world Joe was saying, but all Joe heard was, "Oidem dienka." It was a supernatural event and that was my best attempt at Egyptian and Greek. But from there, people who spoke the same language that God made happen, began to come together in groups and then spread out to find their own living area, away from the other crazy-sounding gibberish speakers. This supernatural event from God caused the people to disband and divide, finally going out to the entire earth, just as God had instructed before they rebelled. In fact, chapter 11 of Genesis demonstrates how specific the Bible gets about how God spread the Table of Nations, which is the account of history more generally outlined in Genesis 10, the overview of the earth's population eventually ventured out across the world after the flood of Noah. Genesis 11 is the specifics on how God did it with the Tower of Babel and with confusion of the languages. Those two chapters working together is similar to how Genesis 1 is the overview of creation and then the history in chapter 2 gets into specifics. Those are not two different events, or time periods, spoken about in either of those pairings. It is just giving specifics after general overviews. Here's my point of mentioning all that. In Genesis 10, God not only tells us He spread people out over the earth, but He specifically said it was in the time of a guy named Peleg, who you and I remember as the origin of our modern-day pirates, right? No, it is not Pegleg. Whoever thought that it's not amusing because you're making fun of people. Actually, that idea was probably just me. Here is Genesis 10:25 talking about Peleg and then Genesis 10:32.
Two sons were born to Eber. One was Peleg, because in his time the earth was divided, his brother's name was Joktan. These are the clans of Noah's sons, according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood.
So, God gives us two historical pieces, the Tower of Babel dispersion of Babylonians across the planet, birthing the nations, and also that this was the time of Peleg. Are those things true? Yes, absolutely. And that is no shocker because the biblical account always gets it right. This is just another example of archaeologists catching up to the Bible's history. Let's talk about that evidence and then get into our study of witchcraft in Egypt. Instead of just the general time frame we have been talking about so far, if we want to get to specifics in biblical dating, Bible scholars say the flood occurred anywhere in 2349 or 2348 BC. So, when you do that math for the genealogy of Peleg, who was born about 2247, his birth was about 100 years after the flood. And when you put the two together, we see this is exactly when the nations of the earth were, not only springing forth across the planet, but just as the Bible tells us, they spread from a single source, which was Babylon. And in a very short period of time, the groups of people of the earth appear to have gotten rid of the Babylonian language they spoke, all their lives, and switched to many completely different tongues. Why would that ever happen if not for God confusing the languages? Now, that's Bible history, what about the secular history? Of course, those records just happen to agree with the biblical account. Babylon was founded in 2234 BC, about 13 years after the birth of Peleg. And as we learned in our creation series, there appears to be another reason they wanted to build a tower after man had gone through a worldwide flood. It wasn't just to make a name for themselves. The other reason was part of their rebellious nature. Here's that account from secular history. Keep in mind that secular history shows about 500 cultures around the world have a flood account in their history, which makes sense because a flood that affected the whole planet would have people talking about it.
Discovered in the histories of the Toltec Indians of ancient Mexico, is the story of the first world that they say lasted 1,716 years and was destroyed by a great flood that covered even the highest mountains. Their story tells of a man named Tapi, who was a very pious man. The Creator told Tapi to build a boat that he would live in and escape the destruction. He was told that he should take his wife and a pair of every animal that was alive into the boat. Naturally, everyone thought he was crazy. Then the rain started, and the flood came.
Today, we Christians go through that same sort of frustration this toppy guy faced, right? We warn people to get into the ark of Jesus because they face death at any moment, which will then make it too late for them. And there is also an event coming at any moment that will be nothing like they have ever seen, the rapture. It will not be Jesus arriving on the earth. Instead, that will be when Christians go up to the sky to meet Jesus. And what do people say to that today? It's something like, okay, you're a wacko. They can think that until they see us leave. Here's more from the Mexican flood legend, and keep in mind that the Bible tells us the water got higher than the tallest mountains, denying anything on earth an escape from God's judgment.
The men and animals tried to climb the mountains, but the mountains became flooded as well. Finally, the rain ended. Toppy decided the water had dried up when he let loose a dove. Following the great flood, people began to multiply and build a very high, great tower. Why? To provide a safe place in case the world was destroyed again.
They sought to deny God the ability to take them out again. Of course, I can't say that account carries the weight of, "Thus saith the Lord," because it is extra-biblical, but it just adds another layer of understanding about the attitude of their rebellion. Here is more of the Mexico legend, and you will see it agrees with Genesis 11.
However, everyone started speaking different languages and the people became confused, so different language groups wandered to other parts of the world. The Toltecs claim they started as a family of seven friends and their wives who spoke the same language. They crossed great waters, lived in caves, and wandered for 104 years until they came to southern Mexico. The story reports that this was 520 years after the Great Flood.
Other secular pieces of evidence that back up the biblical account are Egypt being founded in 2188 BC, 60 years after the birth of Peleg, and the history from a Greek historian named Eusebius, who tells us Greece was founded west of Babylon in 2089, 160 years after the birth of Peleg. So, when you stir all this together, what do we get? Not only were all three nations founded at relatively the same period in history, but each one also spoke different languages. How long do you imagine it takes for a common language to morph into a completely new one? It takes forever. Yet, in just this first small example, there were these three distinct languages and cultures that were each begun in a short amount of time stemming from Babel.
But not only that, notice how Babylon was founded first, which was the closest to the original point of origin. Then Egypt was second, which was a little further away from the point of origin. And finally, Greece was founded third. Exactly like the Bible said, specifically in the days of a guy named Peleg.
So, all that is interesting if you are into Bible history. And you should be. Once again, God gets it right, and I didn't bring all this up just to go through history willy-nilly. Instead, I am exploring the biblical admonition that warns us to stay away from witchcraft. God did not like it when the practices began back in Babylon, and he still doesn't today. Unfortunately, for rebellious reasons, Babylon was not only building that tower, but they also became steeped in witchcraft. Because of that, God dispersed them by handing out random new languages, and one result was that witchcraft got spreading across the planet. I said all that because you'll never learn this history from the back of a granola bar, but also to introduce this next part of our study. According to both biblical and secular accounts, which hugely influential nation was founded first, after the Tower of Babel incident? It was Egypt. So, let's talk about that nation, as far as their witchcraft practices. From the outset, you need to understand that these people were saturated in witchcraft, as a part of everything they did, in every level of society. It is no wonder God judged them with the 10 plagues.
Even though witches are today mostly associated with Halloween and the Salem witch trials, witches have been around for centuries. This is nothing new. The ancient Egyptians were known to practice various forms of witchcraft with a mathematical precision.
It's crazy how much the Egyptians had their witchcraft down to a science. They even made a business out of it.
From everyday healing to treachery in the court, magic, witchcraft, pervaded every aspect of the ancient Egyptian life.
Their term for magic was heka. They believed the world was made by magical, heka, forces that they could tap into for the manipulation of the world, so they would get what they wanted. But heka was also the name for one of their deities.
All deities and people were thought to possess this force to some degree, but there were rules about why and how it could be used. Instead of fearing witches, the ancient Egyptians viewed them with reverence and as a necessity. A witch in ancient Egypt could be called upon to solve any number of problems facing an ordinary citizen. People who controlled the magic were the priests.
So, those depicted in a lot of their artwork are witches, Egyptian priests.
They were the guardians of knowledge bestowed upon humans by the gods so that they could ward off the negative hands of fate. There were different levels of priests, witches. By the first millennium BC, magic was no longer only in the hands of the priests. Witchcraft then began to permeate the whole public sector. It fell to individual magicians and witches who then could control magic to help the people. Midwives and nurses were said to have magic about them to help the sick and women in childbirth. It was also written that wise women might be consulted if a ghost or deity was believed to be causing trouble for someone.
Of course, that last sentence is talking about necromancy, which God condemns. It is exactly the same practice we see today with psychics and mediums consulting spirits, demons. In Egypt, they did it to see what was causing this person trouble in life, and also for healing. So, again, witchcraft was in every aspect of their society. Now, let's start going through their layers of witches, with elector priests being the biggest dogs, having highest status and the most popularity.
The most respected users of magic were the elector priests, who could read the ancient books of magic kept in the temple and palace libraries.
Why was that ability to read so important? It was because hardly anyone in those days could. So, in a witchcraft sense, these elector priests had access to the good stuff, which was the evil texts. They mostly worked for the king, but also grabbed some cash on the side when lectors had their service hired out by average Joites.
Such men were credited with the power to bring wax animals to life or roll back the waters of a lake.
What does that sound like? Of course, it is very similar to what Moses did, except his was on a much grander scale with an entire sea. And I'm thinking that wasn't by chance, as we'll see in a minute. And it was these lector witches that Moses went up against when he approached Pharaoh and demanded him to let my people go. In that story with the snake fight Moses and Aaron started, it wasn't just magicians like we have perform here in Las Vegas. Moses was going up against witches, competing with Egyptian witchcraft. I want to give you some transcript from the movie most of us have seen, and many of us multiple times, The Ten Commandments. Let's remind ourselves of that first encounter Moses had with the witches of Egypt.
Egyptian. What kingdom has sent you? Moses. The kingdom of the Most High. Egyptian. What gifts do you bring? Moses. We bring you the word of God. Ramesses 2. What is this word? Moses. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go. Ramesses 2. Slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they own is mine. I do not know your God, nor will I let Israel go. Moses. Who are you to make their lives bitter in hard bondage? Man shall be ruled by law, not by the will of other men. Ramesses 2. Who is this God that I let your people go? Moses. Aaron, cast down my staff before Pharaoh that he may see the power of God. Aaron, in this you shall know that the Lord is God. Aaron throws the staff on the floor in front of the Pharaoh. Ramesses 2's son. Mother, mother, he turned his staff into a cobra. Ramesses 2's wife. Nothing of his will harm you, my son. Ramesses 2. The power of your god is a cheap magician's trick. Ramesses calls on his lectors, Janus and Jambres, Janus. Janus and Jambres also put their staffs on the ground, turning them into cobras, after which Moses' serpent consumes the other two. Ramesses 2's son. Mother, look. Egyptian magician. Janus, you see? Ramesses 2's wife. Moses' serpent swallows up the others. Moses. You gave me this staff to rule over scorpions and serpents, but God made it a rod to rule over kings. Hear his word, Ramesses, and obey. Ramesses 2. Obey? Moses, Moses. Are there no magicians in Egypt that you have come back to make serpents out of sticks or cause rabbits to appear? Ramesses 2's son walks over to Moses and kicks his staff with his foot. The crowd laughs.
You're going to regret that. So, our study adds another element to this story. Who is Moses going up against? They were witches practicing witchcraft. And we'll talk about how those lectors were able to mimic a couple acts God performed through Moses. But why did Moses and Aaron get that dismissive response from Pharaoh? It was because Pharaoh had seen that done before by his own Egyptian lector witches. So, he thought, whoop-de-doo-da. Our witches can do the same thing. Why listen to you? But how in the world were these lectors able to mimic some of the signs from God that Moses gave, like turning his staff into a snake? We find the answer in Exodus 7 and 8. Why did God give Moses and Aaron supernatural powers to do these miracles in the first place? It was to confirm their message. God knew Pharaoh was going to want a sign. So, God granted the brothers that ability. And it must have been an ominous message for Pharaoh's court when Aaron's snake devoured both of the lector's serpents. Instead of the Hollywood version, if we actually look at the biblical account in Exodus, we find these details.
Twice more, Pharaoh's magicians were able to perform miracles to match the signs of Moses and Aaron. The first plague that Moses called down upon the Egyptians was a plague of blood. The magicians, witches, were also able to turn water into blood as Moses had done to the Nile River. The second plague was a horde of frogs sent among the Egyptian people, and the magicians summoned their own frogs as well, adding to Egypt's problem rather than alleviating it. After this, however, the magicians' power stopped, as they were unable to replicate any further plagues, and they acknowledged they were witnessing the finger of God in Moses' sings.
The Egyptian lectors had to admit they were outmatched, which is a very powerful and important lesson for anyone involved in the occult today. Satan may give you a bit of ability, but it's nothing compared to God. The devil is duping you, so recognize God as the supreme power, drop your vastly inferior occult practices, and run to Jesus Christ. But again, how were those Egyptian magicians able to replicate some of what Moses did? Well, instead of just smoke and mirrors, if they were really able to manifest those things, it was obviously satanic. Scripturally, we know Satan is powerful. He masquerades as an angel of light, and uses his power to deceive people by counterfeiting miracles, signs, and wonders. Although the devil's abilities are nothing like God's, he has some, and I would say that is how those head witches were able to perform that witch magic.
The Egyptian magicians were eventually stymied by God's power. They were unable to summon gnats, turn the sky dark, cool down hailstones, or duplicate any of the other plagues. God's power is great enough to defeat both man's conniving and Satan's power with ease.
Now, let me give you one more aspect of the Exodus events, and it has to do with Pharaoh calling out that certain name when he summoned his witches to battle Moses. The person was Jannes, and he's actually found in the New Testament, along with Pharaoh's other lector witch, Jambres. This is what we see in 2 Timothy 3:8-9, and the context for this passage is Paul describing last days, our modern days, wickedness.
Just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so also these men oppose the truth, men of depraved minds, who, as far as the faith is concerned, are rejected.
But they will not get very far, as in the case of those men, their folly will be clear to everyone.
Adding to that history, though I can't say, thus saith the Lord, because this further evidence comes from Jewish tradition in the Talmud, Jewish oral law, there are a couple other nuggets of information adding some possible detail to the Bible's Exodus account. Again, for what it's worth, this is from the long-standing Jewish beliefs about Jannes and Jambres, the two chief witches of Pharaoh that went up against Moses and Aaron.
According to one Midrash, Talmud commentary, the two magicians left Egypt with the Israelites after the first Passover and were later instrumental in promoting the worship of the golden calf that Aaron made.
Again, those details are not from the Christian Bible but do add a couple of interesting elements to consider, because when many of us watched the Ten Commandments, we were thinking, after all of the Israelites saw God do to them, with the plagues and then even parting an entire sea, how in the world could they rebel and go wicked so quickly, just because Moses took a trip up the mountain? Moses came back down to see some pretty bad behavior. So, he smashed the tablets that God had written his commandments on. Then he told the Levites to go get those horrible people, at which point a bunch of the idol-worshipping Israelites died. Jewish tradition says it was these two witches, Jannes and Jambres, that led or joined that sinful group. Again, we cannot say that information comes as a, thus saith the Lord statement, but maybe those guys had something to do with the Israelites' quick descent into corruption. Also, according to Jewish tradition, Jannes and Jambres continued to exert a wicked influence on Israel and were identified as the two servants of Balaam. Again, it's just conjecture, though it adds some interesting possible aspects of the story. but Paul confirmed that Jannes and Jambres were real people when he mentioned them in the God-inspired writings of the New Testament. And notice that Paul used their names in association with the occult and witchcraft, saying these guys were rebellious against God, just as it will be again in the last days. So, do we see that today? Yes. Here in these last days, we definitely see a widespread rise in witchcraft around the world. Luckily, Paul was letting us know these witches are not going to get very far. Their folly will be clear to everyone. And when Jesus comes back to judge the planet, it will be a hard lesson learned for the occultists, to say the least. Now, let's get back to more on Egypt's lector priests, whose main job was to protect the king.
A lector priest recited spells and hymns during temple rituals and official ceremonies. Such priests also sold their services to the laymen, reciting texts during private rituals or at funerals. They were hired witch guns. As such, they were some of the most prominent practitioners of magic, heku or heka, in ancient Egypt.
The lectors were said to have done amazing feats. And besides being in charge of magic, attending the king, and helping average Joes, lector witches were also responsible for the Egyptian beliefs and practices concerning the afterlife. In fact, you may be familiar with at least one of their tools, the Book of the Dead, which we'll take a closer look at later. Again, in Egypt, witchcraft was in almost every aspect of society and not just for the people who were alive, but also helping with anything having to do with a successful afterlife. As an example, I want to give you this afterlife papyrus, depicting an internal wall in the Pyramid of Unas, built for Pharaoh Unas, who was the final king of the 5th dynasty. Looking at it, you might think the papyrus only shows a wealthy pharaoh's animals and other possessions he had during his life. But instead, it is all magic spells, just like the insides of other Egyptian tombs and sarcophagi, coffins. It all has to do with their witchcraft. I'm telling you, this culture was steeped in it. The papyrus shows on the pyramid walls, having hundreds of magical spells and inscriptions, running from the floor to the ceiling in vertical columns. But instead of calling them what they are, the name given to those magic spells, witchcraft writing on the insides of their pyramids, is just plain old, pyramid texts. And these pyramid texts contain spells needed by the pharaoh in order to survive the afterlife. So, these people were all about witchcraft techniques during life, and then completely relied upon it after death. Unfortunately, it is too late for them because now they are in hell.
The pyramid texts were strictly for the royalty only. The spells were kept secret from commoners and were written only inside the tombs.
The rich guys were the only people allowed to have the best witchcraft, until it ended up permeating the rest of the society. How did that happen? We will get to that in a second. So, the lector priests, serving the king, were the only people who could read. They had stored the magic away in libraries, and even when they did write the spells out in public, the writings were only allowed on the inside walls of the pyramids where no average Joite would see them. But the information did finally get out, and that spread resulted from the tomb raiders. It was Indiana Jones who let those black cats out of the witches' bags and messed everything up. Actually, all this happened in Egypt way before the Indiana Jones movies, but listen to this.
Tomb robbers broke into the pyramids and saw the magical inscriptions. Commoners began learning the spells and inscribed similar writings on the sides of their own coffins, hoping that doing so would ensure their own survival in the afterlife.
Of course, commoners could not afford a pyramid, so they were buried in a coffin. You remember that we had the pyramid texts, and now you can probably guess what they call these writings on the outsides of the average Joe's casket. Yes, they are the coffin texts. Those coffin texts then began to spread, but still some could not even afford a coffin. So, they had this information put with their dead bodies, so the spell started to be written on papyrus, their version of paper. Then when grave robbers began to discover that witchcraft was put on papyrus paper, in these people's resting places, of course, they started to call them papyrus texts. From now on, when you see Egyptian history and they are mentioning papyrus texts, pyramid texts or coffin texts, you'll understand where the names came from, and also know it's all witchcraft. They are not describing animals, creating fancy artwork, or including the dead guy's favorite poem. It is all heavy-duty occult witchcraft.
Eventually, the coffin texts became so extensive that they no longer fit on the outside of a coffin. Instead, they began to be recorded on scrolls of papyrus, which would then be placed inside the coffin with the deceased's own corpse.
So, at this point the cat was out of the bag, with copies of these witchcraft spells everywhere, and everyone able to access the magic spells. With all the different copies and version floating around, what do you suppose they did next? They compiled it all into books, the most famous of which people have come to call, The Book of the Dead. Its real name though is, The Book of Coming Forth by Day, and it is all about witchcraft. As you can see, the picture depicts a set of scales, and there is a term you might have heard that is represented there, you just need to weigh it in your heart. That phrase actually comes from occult practices in Egypt, and the scales are about determining whether you're a good or rotten person, resulting in a positive or negative afterlife.
There are hundreds of different versions of the Book of the Dead, all of them containing different spells. Egyptologists have identified more than 400 different spells belonging to the Book of the Dead collectively.
So, there were a multitude of versions, causing people to codify and classify them based on their purpose. Once books got out into widespread public use, witchcraft was all over society. And remember, this was just spells concerning the afterlife. We haven't yet talked about the average Egyptian's everyday witchcraft. But as this afterlife information proliferated through Egyptian society, its popularity gave rise to a whole industry because now everyone wanted to get their hands on these spells, and also find out how to use them. From here and forward, every Egyptian who thought they might one day die, which was probably all of them, wanted to have a successful afterlife. So, they felt they needed this magic, or they'd be, dead, toast. And people who knew nothing about how to write, which were most, paid for the services of those who did know, making a new business for scribes. Suddenly scribes were making money hand over fist for copying manuscripts. Customers would have the manuscript buried with his or her corpse. Some were up to 90 feet long with beautiful color illustrations to illuminate the text, while others were short with no illustrations. Just like today, I guess it was whatever a person could afford.
The scrolls were copied before they were bought, meaning that the name of the owner was unknown. As such, the scribes would leave the places for the person's name blank and fill it in after the scroll was purchased.
Apparently, much like our form letters, they developed form papyri, that became mass-produced and distributed witchcraft, infecting every aspect of the society. But let's talk about what kind of beliefs it took to make witchcraft so important to these people. Why did they need spells and occult items like amulets to carry around with them? And how did witchcraft become such a necessity for their afterlife? Well, here is that answer in a nutshell. I want to give you the story of Ani and how it relates to their perceived need for magic in the afterlife, which led to their Book of the Dead and why they also needed witchcraft during life. Without witchcraft, they assumed their life would be ruined, and even more so with their afterlife. This is the history of what happened to this guy named Ani, who was a real Egyptian human. This story is based on the writings that were found at his burial site. Here is the video transcript about the witchcraft he banked on to give him a good life.
Ani stands before a large golden scale where the jackal-headed god, Anubis, is weighing his heart against a pure ostrich feather. Ani was a real person, a scribe from the Egyptian city of Thebes, who lived in the 13th century BC. Depicted here is a scene from his Book of the Dead, a 78-foot papyrus scroll designed to help him attain immortality. Such funerary texts were originally written only for pharaohs. But with time, the Egyptians came to believe regular people could also reach the afterlife if they succeeded in the passage.
Ani's epic journey begins with his death.
His body is mummified by a team of priests who remove every organ except the heart, the seat of emotion, memory, and intelligence. It is then stuffed with a salt called natron and wrapped in resin-soaked linen. In addition, the wrappings are woven with charms for protection and topped with a heart scarab amulet that will prove important later on. The goal of the 2-month process is to preserve Ani's body as an ideal form, with which his spirit can eventually reunite. But first, that spirit must pass through the Duat or underworld. This is a realm of vast caverns, lakes of fire, and magical gates, all guarded by fearsome beasts, snakes, crocodiles, and half-human monstrosities with names like He Who Dances in Blood. To make things worse, Apep, the serpent god of destruction, lurks in the shadows waiting to swallow Ani's soul.
Fortunately, Ani is prepared with the magic contained within his Book of the Dead.
Like other Egyptians who could afford it, Ani customized his scroll to include the particular spells, prayers, and codes he thought his spirit might need. Equipped with this arsenal, our hero traverses the obstacles, repels the monster's attacks, and stealthily avoids Apep to reach the Hall of Maat, goddess of truth and justice. Here, Ani faces his final challenge. He is judged by 42 assessor gods who must be convinced that he has lived a righteous life.
Ani approaches each one, addressing them by name and declaring a sin he has not committed.
Among these negative confessions or declarations of innocence, he proclaims that he has not made anyone cry, is not an eavesdropper, and has not polluted the water. But did Ani really live such a perfect life? Not quite. But that is where the Heart Scarab amulet comes in.
It's inscribed with the words, "Do not stand as a witness against me," precisely so Ani's heart doesn't betray him by recalling the time he listened to his neighbor's fight or washed his feet in the Nile.
Now it's Ani's moment of truth, the weighing of the heart.
If his heart is heavier than the feather, weighed down by Ani's wrongdoings, it will be devoured by the monstrous Amit, that is part crocodile, part leopard, part hippopotamus.
Ani will cease to exist forever. But Ani is in luck. His heart is judged pure.
Ra, the sun god, takes him to Osiris, god of the underworld, who gives him final approval to enter the afterlife. In the endless and lush field of reeds, Ani meets his deceased parents. Here, there is no sadness, pain or anger, but there is work to be done. Like everyone else, Ani must cultivate a plot of land, which he does with the help of a Shabti doll that had been placed in his tomb. Today, the papyrus of Ani resides in the British Museum, where it has been since 1888. Only Ani, if anyone knows what really happened after his death, but thanks to his Book of the Dead, we can imagine him happily tending his crops for all eternity.
Actually, Ani has been burning in hell and will do so for all eternity. Unfortunately, that is the fact. But notice the scales that weigh their life. And hearing that story, we may think, those crazy Egyptians. How could they fall for those lies? But just as I do, you probably know, people right here in the United States of America who claim the same belief? They say, hey, as long as our good deeds outweigh the bad, God will let us into heaven. Where do you think that comes from? Again, there is nothing new under the sun. On top of that, if we are to believe this Ani guy's claims on how the afterlife works, what kind of a God would it be if we can just pull a fast one on him by placing a beetle over our heart to lie and cheat our way into a wonderful afterlife? That would be a pretty dumb God. And what about how Egyptians would mummify the corpses? Why were they so big on that? It was to help the body survive as long as possible.
The Egyptians believed that a person's soul could only survive in the afterlife for as long as his or her physical body survived here on earth.
And that is why we hear from different movies that we should not touch or destroy a mummy. Also, during the death rituals, Egyptians had a ceremony for the point just before someone's body was to be sealed inside the tomb. It was called the opening of the mouth, as depicted here.
In this ritual, the priest would touch various magical instruments, performing witchcraft, to various parts of the deceased body, thereby giving the deceased the ability to see, hear, taste, and smell in the afterlife.
So, the mainstream Egyptian society felt they needed witchcraft all through their life, and supposed afterlife, or they would be in big trouble. Witchcraft permeated every aspect of their world.
Before a dead person was buried, his or her mummified corpse would be stuffed full of magic amulets and protective charms in order to ensure that he or she would be safe in the next world. The family would also place important grave goods inside the person's tomb in order to ensure that he or she had everything he or she would need in the next life. Among these grave goods were small figurines made of glazed ceramic or wood known as Shabti.
Now, you might think those little guys are meant to depict someone's friend or family member. Instead, the Shaptis were there to the dead guy's afterlife slaves. Here's what they believed.
The Shaptis were intended as slaves for the deceased. The ancient Egyptians believed that physical labor was just as necessary in the afterlife as it was in the present one.
As you'll remember from Annie's story, even with him supposedly ending up in the good place, he still has to work his little reed farm. And just like today, who would want to keep up that type of farm work for an eternity? No one would. So, this is how they fixed that part of their fiction.
As such, they believed that the deceased could cast a spell to animate these figurines so that he or she would be able to order them to perform tasks and chores in the afterlife so that the deceased would not be forced to perform any labor.
Apparently, the Egyptians even included slavery in their supposed afterlife. And with that, we wrap up the information about lector priests. A second kind of Egyptian priest was the healing priest, who came up with all kinds of concoctions. Just like witches do today, with their potions containing something like the hair from a pig or maybe the popular, I've the newt. Again, this is nothing new under the sun. This was even going on way back then.
Ancient Egyptian physicians treated wounds with honey, resins and metals. In papyri the team also discovered prescriptions for laxatives of castor oil and colocynth, a gourd plant, and bulk laxatives of figs and bran, cumin and coriander were used as intestinal remedies.
I guess Mr. Kellogg, who we credit for creating modern-day cereal, was just a Johnny-come-lately.
They use celery and saffron for rheumatism, and pomegranate was used to eradicate tapeworms.
The Greeks are typically credited with the birth of medicine, but this is why historians believe it was actually the Egyptians. And again, that agrees with the biblical account of the Egyptian civilization coming to prominence, followed by Greece. So, the Egyptians were really the fathers of medicine. But, of course, what was that medicine based on? It was witchcraft, just like the Greeks practiced with aspects of it like their little snake on a pole, the same snake and pole that the AMA, American Medical Association, adopted as their logo. We will talk about Greece in the next chapter.
Magic was not so much an alternative to medical treatment as a complementary therapy. Surviving medical magical papyri contained spells for the use of doctors. The spells were often targeted at the supernatural beings that were believed to be the ultimate cause of diseases. As we saw before, knowing the names of these beings gave the magician, witch, power to act against them. Since demons were thought to be attracted by foul things, attempts were sometimes made to lure them out of the patient's body with dung. At other times, a sweet substance such as honey was used to repel them.
I would say he or she is not such a good doctor if their diagnosis requires some sort of duty, feces, treatment. But these healing priests claim that sweet substances like honey could be used to keep demons away from a person, and if you want to lure demons out of the patient's body, excrement will do that job.
Another technique was for the doctor to draw images of deities on the patient's skin. The patient then licked these off, to absorb their healing power. Collections of healing and protective spells were sometimes inscribed on statues and stone slabs, stelae, for public use.
Again, this is nothing new under the sun.
Doctors were extremely expensive, so, for most everyday purposes, the average Egyptian would have relied on individuals who were not professional doctors, but who possessed some form of medical training or knowledge.
No matter the level of society, they all used witchcraft. And if the average Joeite could not afford a top surgeon, they would go to a local guy, who might know a bit about it, even without the professional training.
Among these individuals were folk healers and seers, who could set broken bones, aid mothers in giving birth, prescribe herbal remedies for common ailments, and interpret dreams.
Maybe relying on witchcraft interpretation of dreams was their problem. And unfortunately, isn't that still all the rage today?
If a doctor or seer was unavailable, then everyday people would simply cast their spells on their own without assistance.
So, if they could not afford any level of witch doctor, they needed to be like that survivalist guy from Man vs. Wild, British Bear, who just does everything himself to survive, whether he has to eat a few bugs, or whatever.
Although most Egyptians were illiterate, it was likely commonplace for individuals to memorize spells and incantations for later use.
Average Egyptians may not have been able to read anything else, but even they knew their witchcraft. This tells you how permeated their society was with witchcraft. Like the Babylonians, the ancient Egyptians saw no distinction between witchcraft and medicine. Witchcraft was their medicine. That covers the lector and healing priests. A third class of witchcraft priests were the scorpion charmers. Lower in status were the scorpion charmers, who used magic to rid an area of poisonous reptiles and insects. There you have the ancient exterminators. If Egyptians had a problem with poisonous reptiles, this would be the guy for the job. Again, all these were depicted on the inner walls of pyramids, just like these women who are also using witchcraft, and in this case, it is being used to help deliver babies. Midwives and nurses also included magic among their skills, and wise women might be consulted about which ghost or deity was causing a person trouble. Of course, if you could not afford even an untrained person and you did not know how to do the witchcraft yourself, once again, you could resort to amulets. As we saw before, amulets were prevalent.
Amulets were another source of magic power, obtainable from protection makers, who could be male or female.
So, if they could not afford the super witch doctor or a lower tier witch doctor, and they couldn't even get that scorpion charmer dude to lend a hand, their last alternative was to buy one of those amulets that they used for spells, protection, and magic. Many of the different amulets people wore or carried on their bodies, wherever they went.
They were considered supernatural fighters, and their job was to protect the home, especially at night when the forces of chaos were felt to be at their most powerful.
And amazingly, that is something people still believe today.
Egyptians of all classes wore protective amulets, which could take the form of powerful deities or animals or use royal names and symbols. Other amulets were designed to magically endow the wearer with desirable qualities, such as long life, prosperity, and good health.
Amulets were also used as good luck charms. They were not just for the living but were also used for the dead to supposedly help make it to the desired afterlife. Today, we wear jewelry for the look of it, but with these people, it was all about the witchcraft. It served a purpose. There is even an amulet that a pregnant woman had better hurry up and get. The Egyptian Torit amulet was in recognition of their goddess of childbirth. If you wore this amulet, it would supposedly protect you from miscarriage. And after the baby is born, they had to take that one off and put on another one. The Egyptian god, Bes, was supposed to be the protector of children, although he looked a bit strange with the head of a lion and the body of a dwarf. I guess children are initially dwarfish, so that may be why Bes was chosen. Now, here is the most popular amulet that most of us will recognize because it's all over the world today, the Ankh. Though the Egyptian Ankh is widespread, even in our times, most do not understand what they're even wearing, but the occult does. The Ankh represents eternal life. As you can see, it resembles a T with a loop on the top. The hieroglyphics show that people didn't just carry the Ankh willy-nilly, the loop acted as a handle. The Egyptian gods and goddesses carried it by the loop. Now, why would that be important? Since the Ankh symbolized life, the life force, and eternal life, the story goes that the gods and goddesses would hold it up to the pharaoh's noses to transfer that life force to the pharaohs so that they could in turn disseminate it to the people. The gods would hold it up to the king's nose in the gesture of basically offering him the breath of life. Another translation of the Ankh is interesting because it parallels occult witchcraft's obsession with mirrors. Some of the old-fashioned handheld mirrors you've seen probably look similar to this. That style came from Egypt's symbol of the Ankh. In fact, all kinds of items in Egyptian culture were in this shape, which symbolized life and eternal life, including mirrors, mirror cases, floral bouquets, libation vessels, and the sistra, which is a musical instrument. And, of course, they were put all over the insides of the pyramids. Here in modern times, occultists are still into Ankhs, especially the goth subculture involving the vampire genre. Gothic culture appreciates the Ankh's connotation of eternal life, as well as the dark implications. But it is not just the goth people. Many witches today add these Ankhs to their collection of witchcraft objects, just like this lady, who picked herself up one of these when shopping at her local witchcraft store. Here is the transcript of a video about that, with the narrator speaking first and then a woman who did some shopping at an online witch store.
The Ankh is an old and ancient symbol that the Egyptians carried throughout their culture. The symbol is an Egyptian hieroglyphic for life or breath of life. And as the Egyptians believed that one's earthly journey was only a part of an internal life, the Ankh symbolizes both mortal existence and the afterlife. The Ankh has a cross shape, but with an oval loop in place of an upper bar. Hey, everybody, I just wanted to show you my shopping, witchy haul today. I did a little bit of shopping because I wanted to buy some things. Isn't this gorgeous? Look at that. She is showing a large Ankh. It's kind of hard to see it, but it's Egyptian. Isn't that beautiful? I bought this from www.thewitchesmoon.com. So, I bought that from them. I have never purchased their boxes. But when I saw this, I loved it. And then, I've got this here. Isn't that cute? She is showing a pentagram. It's like thick ceramic. So, the quality is good. It's a lot nicer than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's nice if you're into pentagrams and other occult witchcraft. But this is still going on today, as we'll see later when we get more into witchcraft practices. Another popular amulet back then was one you've probably seen in artwork. The Egyptian Eye of Horus was used for power and protection.
The Eye of Horus represented the new eye given to Horus by the god Thoth as a replacement for his old eye, which had been destroyed during a battle with Horus's uncle Seth.
Don't you hate when that happens? You are having a pleasant Thanksgiving dinner until a family fight erupts, and pretty soon, someone loses an eye. I guess that may not be in all families. But amulets represented gods, animals, or hieroglyphs and were made of ceramic, stone, metal, bone, wood, and gold. Again, everyone in Egyptian society was getting into witchcraft. A common amulet was the scarab beetle, which symbolized their god, Khepri, who had a beetle head. I don't know about you, but that dude would freak me out. Now let's get into some of their techniques. First of all, timing was important.
Dawn was the most favorable time to perform magic, and the magician had to be in a state of ritual purity. This might involve abstaining from sex before the rite and avoiding contact with people who were deemed to be polluted, such as embalmers or menstruating women or those who ate chicken. Well, maybe not that last one. Ideally, the magician would bathe and then dress in new or clean clothes before beginning a spell.
And again, this is nothing new under the sun because, of course, Harry Potter wasn't the first to use a wand.
Metal wands, representing the snake goddess Great of Magic, were carried by some practitioners of magic. Semicircular ivory wands, decorated with fearsome deities, were symbols of the authority of the magician to summon powerful beings and to make them obey him or her. Some of the ivory wands may have been used to draw a protective circle around the area where a woman was to give birth or to nurse her child. The wands were engraved with the dangerous beings invoked by the magician to fight on behalf of the mother and child. They are shown stabbing, strangling, or biting evil forces, which are represented by snakes and foreigners.
They not only had wands like the ivory one above, but also used witchcraft spells everywhere in Egypt, as people all over the world do still today. Again, the average Joe couldn't read, so spells were used more by the higher ups and kept in libraries. They were also passed down through families, which is probably why there is still so much of it in their society to this day.
A spell usually consisted of two parts, the words to be spoken and a description of the actions to be taken. To be effective, all the words, especially the secret names of deities, had to be pronounced correctly. So, pronouncing it correctly has been important for a long time, again showing, this is nothing new under the sun. The words might be spoken to activate the power of an amulet, a figurine, or a potion. These potions might contain bizarre ingredients such as the blood of a black dog or the milk of a woman who had borne a male child. Music and dance, and gestures such as pointing and stamping, could also form part of a spell.
They not only perform spells, but also curses. These writings say they would use destructive magic, but of course, whether black, white, green, good, or destructive, it's all witchcraft, and all bad. So, the idea today that only some witchcraft is destructive, is just an illusion they attempt to sell us.
The names of foreign enemies and Egyptian traders were inscribed on clay pots, tablets, or figurines of bound prisoners. These objects were then burned, broken, or buried in cemeteries in the belief that this would weaken or destroy the enemy.
In temples, priests would perform curse ceremonies, which may be where the idea of the curse of the mummy comes from. They would also put curses on the enemies of the kings, and they believed acquiring an item that was owned by the intended victim, such as hair, nail clippings, or bodily fluids, would make the curse even more potent. Again, that still goes on today, further proving this is nothing new under the sun. Here is more on their so-called destructive magic, which is bad just like every version of witchcraft.
This kind of magic was turned against King Ramesses III by a group of priests, courtiers and harem ladies. These conspirators got hold of a book of destructive magic from the royal library and used it to make potions, written spells, and wax figurines with which to harm the king and his bodyguards. The treacherous harem ladies were able to obtain such substances as hair and body fluids, but the plot seems to have failed.
The conspirators were tried for sorcery and condemned to death.
From our look at the ancient Egyptian witchcraft history, here's an interesting point. Why, of all nations, did God send these devastating plagues upon Egypt? Yes, the Jewish people were slaves there for about 400 years. But was there another reason he judged Egypt so severely? Well, when you take a look at the pervasive witchcraft throughout all of their society, that was neck deep in evil, I think there's that other side of the story. God was also judging their witchcraft. Let's list exactly what the devastating judgments were, as outlined in Exodus 7-12. This is what happened in Egypt around 1450 BC.
The Lord said to Moses, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart that I may multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt."
It began with the Nile River being turned to blood so that crops were destroyed, causing dead fish to float to the surface of their blood-red, previously life-sustaining river. Drinking water became hard to find. Then came the infestations of frogs and lice, later, gnats and flies. After that was the death of all livestock, followed by every Egyptian experiencing a painful outbreak of boils. Then came the hailstorm, another infestation, this time of locusts, and after that 3 days of darkness. Finally, since Pharaoh's heart was still hard, all firstborn children and firstborn livestock of the Egyptians died. With that last one, the Bible says every Egyptian house had someone dead in it, including the house of the Pharaoh himself. All that really happened to this huge Egyptian society back in those days. Again, why did God judge them? Well, it was certainly that Pharaoh was not letting the Israelites go. However, I think too that it was judgment for their cultural foundation of witchcraft. Their witchcraft practice probably adds a new layer to God demanding of Pharaoh, "Let my people go so that they may worship me, the one and only true God." Was God also saying to let his people go because they have no business being a part of the occult and witchcraft? He wanted them to worship him alone and have nothing to do with Egyptian witchcraft. And, by the way, after God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, what response did he get from them? They whined and complained about how they had it better in Egypt, even with all that slavery. And you wonder why God reacted the way he did when Moses came down from the mountain to see that many Israelites had fallen into paganism so quickly after attaining their freedom. This witchcraft information adds more to the history. Was God being mean when many of those pagan worshipping Israelites were destroyed? No. He was saying something like, "Excuse me. I pulled you out of that slavery, witchcraft, and evil occult worship, yet now you want to tell me you'd rather go back than be with me." Here's something else interesting. God sent 10 specific plagues to the Egyptians that seemed to target their witchcraft and all their false deities that they relied upon to aid in their witchcraft practice. As you can see, why was water turned to blood? It was because Egypt had Khnum, their god of the river source, Hapi, the spirit, demon, of the Nile, and Osiris' bloodstream was said to be the Nile. God let them know it is not those entities who are in charge, God is. Hapi was also the frog goddess of Egypt, Seb was the earth god of Egypt, Lys, Uatchet was the fly god of Egypt, and Ptah, Nevis, Hathor, and Amon were Egyptian gods associated bulls and cows, livestock dying. Sekhmet was the Egyptian god of epidemics, along with Serapis and Imhotep who were the gods of healing, boils on Egyptians. God also sent hail because Nut was the Egyptian sky goddess. Isis and Seth were the Egyptian agriculture deities, crops destroyed. Shu was the Egyptian god of the atmosphere, and Serapia was the Egyptian deity, who protected the locusts. Are you starting to see God's message? He is saying that only the one true God has ultimate power. Why did God send 3 days of darkness? It was because Re, Amon-Re, Aten, Alam, and Horus were the Egyptian sun gods, while Thoth was the Egyptian moon god. So, God let the Egyptians know they would not be getting any light from either of his celestial orbs. And last, why the deaths of the firstborn? You may know already that it was a response to Pharaoh setting himself up as a god, and then through that supposed authority, sending out an order to kill all firstborn of the Jewish people. God let them know that he alone is author of life and has the final decisions over the duration of all our lives. You will not die a day earlier or later than God has planned for you. So, why worry about it, right? God judged Egypt because of the slavery of his people, but he also specifically attacked every one of the deities that their whole society followed because of their foundation in witchcraft practices. And if God did not like witchcraft in the occult then, do you think he's changed his mind since? Of course, the answer rhymes with no. And if God told the Egyptians to free his people from that witchcraft, do you think he wants us to be a part of it today? Absolutely not. He did not like it then and is still against it for us.